I'm Carson Sestouli of Fangraphs.com, and this is the Pitch Talks Blue Jays podcast, brought to you by Homestand Sports. It is the Pitch Talks Blue Jays podcast. I'm Carson Sestouli, managing editor of Fangraphs.com. With me, joining me, serving as my co-host for this particular episode, is not Dave Cameron, because Dave Cameron no longer works at Fangraphs.com. Indeed, during the offseason, he was hired by the Padres to work in some capacity with their research and development department. The Padres research and development department. So what we have here instead is a much superior guest. He's a lead prospect analyst for Fangraphs.com. It's Eric Longenhagen. Eric is here. Eric, I believe you're here. Is that right?
Yes, this is the sound of my voice.
Very good. Thank you, Alan Partridge. Here, let me tell you why this exists very briefly. Kevin Kennedy has contracted us to provide dispassionate analysis about the Toronto Blue Jays. So that is, we'll say that is the raison d'etre of this podcast. Allow me to tell you who Kevin Kennedy is, for example, or for a moment. He is the owner-operator of Homestand Sports. Homestand Sports runs a series of events, including what are known as Pitch Talks events. Pitch Talks events are these sort of gatherings where people, usually of a majority age, gather and have a how do we describe it with Travis Sochik last week? It was combination symposium and town hall meeting. Symposium town hall meeting. Now, I believe that you, I think that you were scheduled to participate in one, but then maybe Kevin Kennedy himself fell ill. Is that right?
That's correct. Yeah, here in Phoenix.
Right. So unfortunately, but Kevin Kennedy is, to the best of my knowledge, he's entirely healthy now. And to the other best of my knowledge, there will be a Pitch Talks event in June, mid-June, June 14th, 6 to 9 p.m. at the Rec Room. June 14th, 6 to 9 p.m. at the Rec Room. It's a Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame special event. It'll include not only announcer Dan Shulman, but also some notable Canadian, some ballplayers of note in Canada. For example, Toronto Blue Jays alumnus Lloyd Mosby, and also a special guest, Montreal Expos alumnus Pedro Martinez. Pedro Martinez, one of the greats. One of the greats, we'd all have to agree. You can go ahead and buy tickets at homestand.ca. That's homestand.ca. Once again, the Canadian Baseball Hall of Fame night with Pitch Talks, June 14th, 6 to 9 p.m. June 14th, 6 to 9 p.m. June 14th, 6 to 9 p.m. at the Rec Room. And that's it. That's it. That's how we pay homage to our patron, Eric Longenhagen. It's been done.
I still have notes from scouting Pedro in 2009 somewhere in the desk that I'm sitting at.
What are you talking about?
That was when he pitched on the 2009 Phillies. They signed him in the middle of the season. They needed rotation depth as they made a defense of their title. And so they signed Martinez, and he came up, you know, rehabbing through the minors. I saw him pitch at Triple-A Lehigh Valley, and then I saw him in person at an actual Phillies game later that year. And I've got scouting notes on like 37-year-old Pedro Martinez somewhere in this desk.
What is do you have off the top of your head? Do you remember what 37-year-old Pedro Martinez looked like?
Yeah, he was like 86 to 89 early, and once he got a lather going in the middle innings, he was like 89 to 92, maybe touch a 3 or a 4. Fastball still had a lot of movement. And I mean, his secondary stuff was still in the 50-55 range. He looked, you know, if you wouldn't have known it was Pedro Martinez, you'd say this guy is a perfectly fine fifth starter. Mm-hmm. It just takes a little while to get going.
You say, is that a scouting term you frequently employ until he worked up the lather?
Not frequently, but
relevant
on
here?
Occasion, yeah. If I've been around, my grandparents long, like for a little while, as I have been recently, then yeah.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. That's how to get that word back.
It's an old person phrase.
Allow me to inform you how the Blue Jays have done over, I suppose, roughly the last week, the last seven games. They're 3-4 over that stretch. They're 3-4 over that stretch, which is unfortunate, anything below 500, because they are in such a competitive division, Eric Longenhagen. They play in the same division as the Yankees and the Red Sox, two teams that have won more than two-thirds of their games. As a result, the Blue Jays, despite possessing what is, I think, a decently strong roster, and despite possessing a projected rest of season win percentage above 500, have nevertheless seen their playoff odds decline, not precipitously, but substantively. The chances of making the playoffs now down 11 points since last week, under 20% now, 17.5% is what we're roughly saying at Fangraphs.com. So, not a great week, and the offense was not great. They produced over the last week or so zero wins above replacement. Zero wins above replacement, led, I guess, by Luke Maley. Actually, Luke Maley and Russell Martin were two of the three players to produce a positive WAR mark over the course of the week. I understand that a week is a short amount of time. This is not predictive, of course, but it's a good shorthand for determining who's been performing. The pitching staff was middle of the road. However, let me tell you, a bright spot is the bullpen. The bullpen was better than any other bullpen over the course of last week.
Debatable.
What's that? Oh, well, on the field, their performance is what I mean to say. Go. Yeah. Led by Sam Gaviglio. Does that shock you? Does that shock you that Sam Gaviglio?
I think that he's a big league reliever. And in short bursts, some of these guys have, six, seven inning hot streaks where they're, so I could see that.
Yeah, so Gaviglio, Sengwano, Ryan Tepera, and Tyler Clippard all threw at least three innings, and were all lights out, all of them. Very good. I think that they only allowed, I don't know, maybe two runs between them, or between the four of them. So the bullpen was actually quite strong over the last week. At least two of those parts were not there last year. Clippard, I believe, was... that's not really my responsibility to know. That's fine. I'm not an expert. This is a dispassionate analysis. But anyway, that's not really why we're here.
Dispassionate does not mean ill-informed. Clippard pitched for three teams last year, so I guess it doesn't really matter. Like, Clippard has been with multiple teams each of the last 3 years.
Yeah. It's around. Here, let's discuss why you're here. All right, and it's actually twofold. All right, so you have a twofold responsibility in this edition of the Pitch Talks Blue Jays podcast. Your first objective is to, first of all, to note Kevin Biggio's performance this year, and then to explain, if you can, why he's been so good. And then secondly, to give us a bit in the way of a draft preview for the Toronto Blue Jays, because here it is, May 15th. The draft, I think, is 2 weeks and 6 days away from where we are.
Yep.
And you and your colleague at Fangraphs.com, Kylan McDaniel, just released today your second mock draft, which was similar to the first one, except with more information. And something that I like, probably my very favorite part of it, which is the front office sightings. I don't know if I'm phrasing that correctly, but...
Yeah, I'd say
personnel
that
personnel from each of the teams in attendance. I know that, and I think it's Kylie's term, but he uses the term heat. Oh, a lot of heat at that game.
Yeah.
Scouting
to scouts is the way to...
I'm fine with that as well.
How I've heard it put as well.
Yeah, and so you can maybe tell us about the Toronto Blue Jays and where they'll be picking and who and why. But first, let's turn our attention to Kevin Biggio. Kevin Biggio plays on the same team both as Vladimir Guerrero Jr. and Bo Bichette, the top two prospects. Not only are they the top two prospects in the Jays system, they're both top 10 prospects in baseball.
Yeah.
And it's a bit misleading to say, but I'll say it anyway, that Kevin Biggio has more home runs than the two of them combined. Misleading because Bichette has zero home runs, and Vlad Guerrero has been quite good. But this is not something necessarily that one might have expected out of Kevin Biggio. Could you please provide, I guess, don't provide a beef profile. I'd like a brief profile of Kevin Biggio, and perhaps how that profile might be amended given what we have in the way of new data.
Yeah, Biggio was, he's Craig Biggio's kid, so he was famous in high school as players, especially who were as good as Craig Biggio was. Like when they have offspring that are playing in these high-profile showcase events that are heavily scouted, like these, they're players of interest. A lot of people have reports in on them. So we've known about Biggio for a while, and the Phillies tried to take him out of high school late. Couldn't get a deal done. He went to Notre Dame and then just sort of disappeared. He lasted till the fifth round of the 2016 draft. And in pro ball has been pretty middling up until this year. His approach has been good, but otherwise he hasn't hit for any power, has been just okay at second base, and has been old for every level that he's played at. And he still is. He's 23. The thing that's different this year is there has been a substantive mechanical change. He used to have almost like a Mike. Remember Mike Avila's? What his?
Yes, I do. Yeah, yeah, yeah. Played, was kind of like a fringy shortstop, but had some kind of offensive game.
Right. He was, you know, just a good like bat the ball middle infielder for a long time. If you can remember visually what his batting stance was like and sort of where he. There's a garbage truck right outside my house right now, if you can't tell.
Yeah. Actually, just now, of course, many of our listeners would be Canadian. This is a common occurrence in America, is because the entire country is made up of garbage. You just find garbage trucks everywhere.
Everywhere.
Yeah.
Anyway, throughout his pro career, Biggio has had sort of a similar hand position as Avila's used to, if you want to try to get a visual of it and haven't seen Biggio. He'd load his hands way up high near his head, up near his ear, and his hand position has dropped to something closer to like his chest and shoulder area this year. And what it allows for is Biggio has always had like that stereotypical left-handed swing. That low ball uppercut, like natural uppercut swing. And so his hands just have less distance to travel now than they did when he was loading his hands way up near his head before the bat path is on plane with the baseball. And so the result has been his ground ball rate is down to 27% this year. It was
from around 36 last year, looks like.
Right, yeah, and 41 the year before that. His fly ball percentage, which is a little more subjective because, you know, the area between line drive and fly ball is sort of gray, whereas, you know, just ground ball is, if it's on the ground, it's a little more objective to evaluate that. But the fly ball percentage is up to 60%, up from 43% last year. So there's been a mechanical change. There has been a resulting change to the batted ball profile, and there's been an uptick in his power production. So the combination of that, there's the strikeout rate is still concerning. He is a 23-year-old at AA, striking out 25% of the time. That's a concern. You take the output with a grain of salt because of his age as well. But there has been a mechanical change. He's a very patient hitter. He's got a 16% walk rate on the year. It was 30% last year. That's pretty consistently good, well above average. So, yeah, like, he wasn't on the main section of our prospect list at Fangraphs. We mentioned him in the Others of Note section, but he's moving up, and he'll be a Form 40 future value when we update the list. His stock is definitely up, but still not someone who we're, like, anticipating be an everyday player or anything like that. Not yet.
You know, interesting thing, and this is can be now. I remember this is some time ago when Fangraphs added strikeout and walk percentage to the site. Right before that, it was just you know, in particular for pitchers, it was K per nine and walks per nine. Right, but the problem with this with a metric like strikeouts per nine is that pitchers who walk a number of batters can actually their strikeout per nine figures can actually be artificially inflated, right? Because they'll walk a batter, maybe a tougher batter, and then they'll strike out a weaker batter, and so this actually benefits their strikeout numbers. Despite the fact, well, it's relevant here, is what I mean to say, because Kevin Biggio, despite the fact that he actually has a strikeout rate that's considerably higher than Vlad Guerrero's, in fact, nearly three times as high, Vlad Guerrero Jr., who, of course, he's very good. He's doing he's doing horrible things to Eastern League pitchers right now. But Kevin Biggio has struck out in nearly three times more plate appearances than he has on a rate basis. Vlad Guerrero Jr.'s strikeout rate is under 9%. Kevin Biggio is about 25%. Biggio, however, is actually swinging and missing at fewer pitches. And it's probably just because he's taking more overall. But Biggio's swing strike rate is just above 8%, whereas Vlad Guerrero Jr.'s is 2 percentage points higher than that. So that's a little bit of an observation that might reveal some of the, some of the tricks that numbers can play a little bit. I don't know if you find that interesting at all, Eric, but
yeah,
that's
I do.
A fact. Yeah, that's a fact nonetheless. all right, so that's Kevin Biggio hitting for a bunch more power, likely a function of change in swing mechanics. And now you said old for the level, he's 23. I think probably like, now I'm guessing you like old for a prospect. I think that probably the average Eastern League age is about 23.
Yeah,
but that's not necessarily the average age for a player about from whom one expects major league success.
Right. Unless there are extenuating circumstances, it's rare for someone to be that old at Double A and be considered like a top prospect.
Someone who'd make
our top 100 list or something like that.
Right. Yeah, I have to think. I'm trying to think like players recently who have actually cobbled together major league careers, pretty much older than that. I think Steve Souza was like kind of famously.
Yeah, Souza had makeup issues.
Late developing. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ben Zobrist before that. Obviously,
yeah. Nelson Cruz,
okay, yeah,
was 27 when he started hitting. Like it does happen. It's just age, especially for hitters, is a telling age relative to level is a pretty telling aspect of the profile.
Right. Okay. Now let's get to the other matter of interest here, which is the draft, which is actually fast approaching at this point. The Toronto Blue Jays, to the best of my knowledge, have the 12th overall pick.
Yep.
And when I gaze here at the mock draft that you and Kyle McDaniel have published just today, you submit that, and this is all sort of a question of probability, as I understand, but from your vantage point, the most likely outcome for the Blue Jays is to select a left-hander from Arizona, not far from you, I believe, Matthew Liberatore. Now, here's what I would like from you. I'd like you to tell me a little bit about Matthew Liberatore, but I would also like you to tell me, after you're done doing that, more about the sort of context of this pick and other possible options at that pick.
Sure, yeah. So Matthew Liberatore, arguably the best high school pitching prospect in this year's draft. If you remember Jason Groom from a couple years ago, Libby is pretty similar to Groom without some of the off-field baggage that scared teams away from Groom.
Was it Jay Groom like a Philadelphia area guy?
Yeah, from New Jersey.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Barnegat High School in New Jersey.
But there was some weird were there weird questions about where he was going to high school, etc.
Yeah, so Groom was originally from New Jersey and then spent a year at IMG Academy. It's like a high school athletics academy in Florida, and then he came back to New Jersey for his senior year, but the paperwork that he filled out wasn't entirely correct, and so he was suspended for a certain amount of time, and he had an eventful high school time. Like it was the experience, the Jay Groom experience was pretty varied. Libby, things are a little more stable. He's been up to 95 or 96 in just about every outing, certainly in every outing that I've seen, and I've seen five. Mostly 91, 94. He's got the best curveball in the draft. He's been developing a slider this spring only. You know, he unveiled it a couple starts into the year, and it has developed and will show you 50 or 55 once in a while on the scouting scale. There's some changeup feel there as well. He's interested in, but is not necessarily utilizing certain aspects of pitching well, like quick pitching slide steps, varying the timing of his delivery. Like, he does all that stuff. He just doesn't do it correctly yet. But the interest in it is there. And so, you know, you might ask yourself, why do you think that the best high school pitcher in the draft is going to fall to the 12th pick? And the answer to that is that high school pitching just tends to fall.
I know. You and Kylie mentioned that a couple times, and I'm curious as to why that is. You think?
Well, some of it is a bias, and some of it is just correct. So obviously, the teams picking at the top of the draft are there for a reason, and you can deduce that reason. And the people who work for that team want to keep their jobs, and so. It behooves them to hit on these top five, top 10 draft picks. It's important for their career prospects. So that's part of why you see the college players move to the top of the draft. So that's part of it. And just like high school pitching and just pitching in general, and of course high school pitchers are almost always farther away developmentally than their college counterparts are, so there's just more time for something to go wrong medically. So they're volatile. They're the most volatile demographic in the draft. And just because of the way this draft shakes out, or the way we anticipate it will shake out, it's going to be a lot of college players early. And there are four, five, maybe six high school players who, just on talent, probably belong up in that top group with some of these college players who are going to go in the top five, six picks. So just by the nature of the draft, a couple of them are going to be around when the Blue Jays pick at 12. It might not necessarily be Matthew Liberatore. It could be any of the other quality high school pitchers, or the two high school bats who we happen to think are the two best in the class, and Nolan Gorman, a third baseman from Arizona, and Jared Kelnick, an outfielder from Waukesha, Wisconsin. Either of them could be around for Toronto, too. And this is sort of the area that we think the Blue Jays are looking at. It's which of these hyper-talented high schoolers is going to fall to us artificially. And whoever that is, again, might not necessarily be Libby, is who we think the Blue Jays are on. We think that they've been scouting these guys heavily in anticipation of this happening. And that they're going to they want to feel confident that who is left of this group when they're on the clock at 12 is who they'll end up selecting.
You mentioned that the Jays are on the first team on a Florida prep center fielder, Connor Scott.
Yeah, so Connor Scott goes to Plant High School in Florida, which is where Astros prospect Kyle Tucker and his brother Preston went to high school, and where former Cardinals first-round pick Jacob Woodford went to high school. So it's like a big baseball school in Florida. Connor Scott is sort of similar to Austin Beck, who the Athletics drafted last year at 6th overall, in that he wasn't on the summer showcase circuit the year before, which when high school players are on this high school showcase circuit during the summer, playing at these Perfect Game and Under Armour events and things like this, and they hit against a higher concentration of pitching talent, it gives teams, especially forward-thinking teams like Toronto, whose draft models weigh performance during this summer showcase season, they weigh it more heavily. It gives them more confidence that guys like that are going to hit when they do it against elite competition. So Scott was not on that.
And why wasn't it? Do you know?
I forget why. He's been hurt pretty consistently, even into this spring, and not everyone has seen him. This is one of those situations where, you know, when we're piecing together the mock drafts, the information that goes into it is we have discussions with player advisors. We use what teams have done in the past. We pattern recognition of what type of players these teams, these general managers and scouting directors especially have shown interest in the past and drafted. And then where do we see important people from your organization at games? Was your general manager at Matthew Liberatore's best start of the year where he was 93-97 his entire start, well, then that probably influences how your organization lines up Matthew Liberatore on your board. And so that's some combination of that is why we have Scott attached to Toronto. He's pretty tooled up, runs well. There's some power there, and but obviously he's one of the more volatile candidates on in a group of players, you know, high school position players who we haven't seen perform against elite pitching, just, you know, normal high school pitching during the spring. I mean, that's a pretty volatile group bucket to be placed into. So, you know, I think there's a non-zero chance they're considering him there, but I do think there's going to be someone of greater value who ends up falling to that pick, which is why we have Libby Mock there.
All right. Yeah. Well, I appreciate not only the explanation about Liberatore himself, but also the thinking behind it. What a pleasure, Eric Langenhagen.
Oh, the pleasure is mine.
Hey, let me tell you, let me do something. The way we end it typically is to look at the week ahead for the Toronto Blue Jays. what we find here are two series, roughly speaking, just a two-game series against the New York Mets, and then a four-gamer home against the Oakland A's. Playing the Mets, the team the Blue Jays will face Noah Syndergaard, who's quite good. And then they'll face Zach Wheeler, who is mercurial. He is mercurial. He's 28 now, but at some point he was, I think, a sixth overall pick or something like that.
Yeah, and the Beltran trade, right, from San Francisco.
Ah, yes, that's right. So wait, tell me. So Wheeler's actually made six starts this year, and while the ERA is not fantastic, some of the sort of indicators are better than that, and he still seems to have his velocity. But I guess I'm curious if you could just very briefly kind of maybe provide some context for Wheeler. Like, from where has he come? Because I feel like the name has been around for some time.
Yeah, I guess he really has, right? I mean, he turns 28 at some point this season, early enough that this is his age 28 season. He's been around the big league since 2013, so I guess, yeah, he would have debuted at like 22 or 23. He was just, you know, one of these hard-throwing high school righties who has his, you know, at some points throughout his career has looked like a potential top-of-the-rotation starter, and at others has been hurt. Like, mostly he's been hurt, you know, like a lot of the Mets pitching prospects and just their big league pitchers too have been over the last half decade or so. He was part of the I mean, the Giants had a lot of high end pitching talent in their system and was generally seen as, you know, with Bumgarner and Tim Alderson. If you remember Tim Alderson, yeah. So
did Alderson? Did he end up at the Pirates? Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how things eventually ended there, but I think they have. And it's just, you know, this is a pitching prospects are volatile. And so when you look at someone like Wheeler, and the way we tend to do this at FanGraphs is, you know, the range of potential outcomes for these guys resembles a bell curve like anything else. And somewhere in the middle of that population is what Zach Wheeler has become, which is this frustrating mid-rotation starter, back-of-the-rotation start, like something sort of in that range. You know, at points early in his career, it looked like he, you know, you hoped that he would become more than that, and it hasn't quite come together to this point. So he's pretty typical, you know, as far as it seems like it's been this long, frustrating career, but this is how a lot of these guys shake out. And some of them, after a couple years of big league development, become Carlos Carrasco, and then some of them turn into this. And it's just, you know, things after the prospect side has passed these guys off to the more mainstream baseball media, there's still a lot of development that occurs, or a lot of development that doesn't occur, as it seems to.
I have to think the fact that he's retained his velocity has to be at least some sort of positive indication.
Yeah.
Right? You agree?
Sure.
You agree?
Yeah.
You're not.
He's just not. He's just never developed command. You know, he's been a.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know what the walk rate is off the top of my head, but you know, there were some years early on there where it looked like it might be coming, and it just hasn't. You know, how many? Some of it is just team need, right? Because if you look at in Zach Wheeler's career, mm-hmm. He's walked 180 hitters in 400 innings, right? So just a little under a hitter every other inning, which is, in my opinion, like that's sort of where you start to if I'm just glancing at a prospect's stat line and that's the case, I'm asking my sources, like, hey, are you confident that this guy can't start? Because in my opinion, like a walk every other inning is sort of where you start to get on the fringes of a guy being able to profile as a starter. And that's what Wheeler's been for 4 years in the big leagues. In some organizations who have better pitching depth, who have more health, like this guy is just a reliever. This guy has just been converted to the bullpen. And maybe he's dominant. You know? So it's just one of those things where an individual player's development is more dependent upon context than we realize. It's team specific as far as that player's player development, as far as that team's player development competency is or is not, and just given the situation on the rest of the roster at the time when he is ready to be in the big leagues. Like, there's a whole lot that has nothing to do with the player that really impacts their development pretty significantly, and I think Wheeler's an example of this.
Hey, you know what that is? It's good stuff. It also represents the last words, or nearly the last words you'll speak on this edition of Pitch Talks Blue Jays podcast. What do you think about that, Eric Longenagan?
That's fine.
Yeah, that is fine. Good. Well, what I would like to do is I'd like to thank you, Eric.
You're welcome.
That has been Lead Brass Baiting List for Fangraphs.com. Eric Longenagan, I'm Carson Sestouli, and this has been the Pitch Talks Blue Jays podcast.